It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks to a caller request seeking more information about gambling disorder in our state and treatment options for recovery, we turn to the Wisconsin Council on Problem Gambling, and you can be part of the conversation, calling in with a question, sharing your thoughts at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Patricia Yerovets is board president of the State Council, a licensed professional counselor and internationally certified problem gambling counselor in Oshkosh. Patricia, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with the forms of gambling. What are examples of legal gambling in Wisconsin?
Well, in Wisconsin, gambling is legal, like on the casinos, in the casinos on the tribal lands. There's also there's slot machines in some of the restaurants and gas stations, and those are allowed as long as they're not. You don't have over five, but that's where most of the legal gambling in the state is located.
Who benefits from the revenue that's being generated by gambling in Wisconsin?
Well, we do get a little bit of property tax relief from the lottery that the state has goes into the state's general coffers, and the money that's made at the state handles.
And do some of those profits, though, the revenues generated, do they go into resources and support for problem gambling?
The Wisconsin Council on Problem Gambling, we provide resources, public awareness, and education on gambling disorders while maintaining strict neutrality on the issue of legalized gambling. And we were formed in 1993 in Green Bay by some concerned counselors and businessmen who were concerned about the increase they were seeing in their customers and clients with problem gambling. So it started out with money for a helpline, and then from there it increased to public awareness and providing services to the gamblers.
There's also the self-help group, Gamblers Anonymous. What impact is that program making?
That's a very solid, good programming for people recovering. It's based on the 12-step program of AA. However, there are a lot fewer meetings throughout the state for gamblers than as there are for other addictions. The council does have, if you go on our website, there's a lot of resources there for everyone. It has the list of the GA meetings and Gammonon meetings throughout the state by county. It also lists the counselors, problem gambling counselors throughout the state by county. So if you go online, there's a lot of information there. There's also some screening questions that, if you're concerned that you might be having a problem, there's we call it the 20 questions, and if you answer those, can help you make the decision if you need to seek more help. And there's also a 20 questions questionnaire for family members. Are you living with somebody with a family gambling problem? So, and our helpline is answered 24/7 by trained volunteers.
Wow.
And last year, we had 15,000 calls on the helpline. So there is a lot of interest out there.
We're talking about gambling with Patricia Yerovets, president of the Wisconsin Council on Problem Gambling. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Patricia, what might be the lesser recognized, the less visible forms of gambling?
Yeah, and that definitely is, like the online gambling. 25 years ago, if someone asked you, where can you go gamble, you'd have said a casino, because that was about the only place to go. And for a short time in Wisconsin, there were some dog tracks. But now the closest place to gamble is on your phone. And so Gambling can be very secretive. We call it the hidden disease because it's not seen. You don't smell it on somebody. You can't do a blood draw and find out if the person's a gambler. It's very hidden that way. So generally, significant others or spouses don't find out about the problem until there's a crisis of
In
some
this,
sort.
yes, in this online world, what are the effects of fantasy sports sites and online sports betting? What have you experienced?
Well, there's been a lot. There's been an increase. Of course, there's a lot of more legalized gambling. Sports gambling or sports betting is legal in 36 states. So you can go a lot of places, and most online bets, the information that I've researched shows that 30% of the online bets are $50 or over, and 1 in 10 are $250, average $250 a bet. So sports betting in the past 5 years has totaled $235 billion is the estimate.
Oh my goodness, wow.
That's a lot of money betting on sports. And teens are of concern because their brains are developing. That frontal lobe that gives us reasoning isn't fully developed till age like 26. So it's like teenagers go through a lot of brain changes, and so if they're involved in the gaming as well as sports betting, it can affect how their brain gets developed. Video
Do
games.
oh, I was going to say, do some apps and games on our teen's phone have gambling themes and content?
Yes. Video games are kind of set up with the same reward structure as a slot machine, where it's unpredictable. You know you're going to win, but you just don't know when. And gambling has that unique quality that your brain spikes and your dopamine spikes at an almost win as well as winning. So that's where it becomes a problem is you become obsessed with it, making the next bet because your brain is firing off like if you just won.
Right, because like after losing, how strong is the urge of feeling you have to return as soon as possible to win back those losses?
Yeah, exactly. That's one of the symptoms of when it becomes a gambling problem rather than just, fun gambling is we call it chasing your loss. The bank has or the casino has all your money, and so you have to go get it back. And so chasing or gambling more online, like gambling longer times and bigger amounts to kind of get that back.
Patricia Yurovets is an internationally certified problem gambling counselor, board president of the Wisconsin Council on Problem Gambling. Call in with a question. You can share your concerns at any point. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. In response to a caller request, we learn about gambling disorder in Wisconsin, what constitutes problem gambling, and resources to support people in recovery. Call in with a question. You can share comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Patricia Yurovets, board president of the Wisconsin Council on Problem Gambling. Let's bring in Marnie in Sun Prairie. Hi, Marnie.
Hey.
What would you like to share?
Well, I just had a question. I know there's GA and that essentially, it seems that their goal is to make you cut gambling like cold turkey, or not necessarily cold turkey, but they don't want you to gamble at all. That's their goal. I would like to learn how to gamble smart, if that's even a possibility. Right now, I know that I can't do that. So what, I went to a casino and blocked myself for a year in order to try to get control of myself. But eventually, I would like to be able to go to a casino and enjoy it and not be stupid about it.
Marnie, thank you so much for sharing that experience and that situation. Patricia, is it possible for a person to place bets responsibly and still enjoy the casino experience?
There is. There's a treatment plan out there called harm reduction, which is, you know, reducing the amount of gambling that you do and gambling responsibly. And you can find, you know, a counselor to help you with that. GA meetings do foster like abstaining from gambling. Many gamblers find that you know, money can be a trigger, and it's hard to control the money and not misuse it for gambling. So, but yeah, there are some treatment plans out there for reducing your gambling, and there are, you know, a number of gamblers who, you know, start with that method and see if that works for them.
What is counseling therapy like?
Well, the main treatment plans that seem to work the best for gamblers are like cognitive behavioral therapy or dialectical behavior therapy, mindfulness. So there's different modalities out there that can help you get in a good place with your gambling, either stopping completely or, you know, like Marnie said, she'd rather gamble responsibly. And so working on that.
Do you hear that from patients who really want to try to figure out how to have a realistic balance with gambling?
Yep, you do. You get clients like that who'd like to just gamble responsibly. It, you know, it is difficult to give up gambling altogether for those who have had a severe into the addiction. Abstaining is generally the route to go to stay clean. But there's certainly a lot of different things people can try. There's a lot of shame and guilt with gambling and a high suicide rate. So I would encourage anybody who feeling that way to call the helpline and get some information.
Yes, 3-988. How is gambling addiction different from substance addiction?
Yeah, it is. With gambling, excuse me, with gambling, you don't black out. You know, you don't pass out from doing too much gambling. You aren't ingesting anything, so it can't be, they can't smell it on you. They can't, you know, they don't see you stumbling. You know, you don't stumble around when you're gambling. But it has the same progression in that, you know, you need to bet more and more in order to get the same effect. There's different with substance abuse, usually families are aware of it as it's happening, that it's getting worse. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times with the gambling, it's hidden. And so family and other members don't know about it until, oh, the car wasn't stolen, it was repossessed. Our house is, you know, in foreclosure. Or, you know, there's usually a big financial component that you don't see with alcohol or drugs.
How can families support a member with a gambling problem?
Yeah. Call the helpline and go on our website and check out our website. We have information there for family members. You know, one of the things you have to do is ask. And of course, the question is generally not received well by the gambler who's trying to deny how bad it is and not face, you know, what they've done to the family or how it's going to affect the family. So If you go online, there's some information there for family members. Like if you feel you're living with a loved one who has a gambling problem. We also have a state conference every year. In fact, in 2024, we'll have our 25th state conference. There's 2 days of a lot of presentations and workshops, and some of the presentations and workshops are geared towards family members and recovering gamblers. So it's not only for the counselors, but it's for the gambler and their families also.
When you identify the types of gamblers, the social gambler, the problem gambler, the compulsive gambler, there are also references to the to gambling disorder. How are the types of gambling different from gambling disorder?
Well, it all depends on like if you can, most of us are social gamblers, like 90% of us. We will decide that, okay, we're gonna go to the casino, or go down to the local bar and gamble on some of those, and it's a fun night out. We determine how much money we're gonna spend. We spend it. If at the end of the night we had a good night, it was a fun night out, we go on with our life. We probably when it starts beginning to be a problem, the gambler becomes obsessed with, like placing the bet, like having enough money. How can I sneak out and go gamble some more? So it no longer becomes just fun.
Or a
They get
form of
rather obsessed about
entertainment.
it. And then they have to bet more. And then vacations can be geared around where we can stop to gamble, right? Along the way as we go to the Grand Canyon with the kids. So it becomes an obsession, and the goal is to have enough money to place that next bet.
Patricia Yerovets is president of the Wisconsin Council on Problem Gambling. As we talk about gambling disorder, you can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Patricia, loot boxes, video game mechanics that researchers say are similar to other forms of gambling like slot machines, video games using loot box mechanics can be geared toward kids. How else are gambling mechanics used in video games?
Yes, well, in a lot of video games, you can either with winning gems or coins within the game buy different things, and you can also pay cash, pay into it with real money to get those things. And so, there's inline casinos within the game, and they don't bet real cash. But like I said, you can put money into the game. You bet the game's coins in the casino, and they don't pay out. And that's where they kind of that loophole is of is it gambling or is it gaming? Because there's no actual payout. But the mechanics of it run similar to, like I said, slot machines. It's like it's random. And you're probably going to win, but not when. So.
Are there some common gambling triggers to try to avoid?
One of the first pieces of treatment is to getting the gambler to recognize that money is a trigger. And so getting having where what has to happen to the control of the money, and not if you're the gambler is the person who's always handled all the affairs of the family to say turn your money over to somebody else while you get this under control. That's not an easy thing to do. We don't talk much about money in this in our society. It's even within families. A lot of our elderly parents say, well, when I die, you get what's left, and you aren't even aware of like what financial shape your parents are in. So it's not something that anybody's very comfortable talking about. And so when you aren't doing well with money, it's still there's that stigma out there that, it's just a matter of of self-control. You know, like you aren't going to go to a friend and say, "Oh my gosh, I'm $20,000 in debt here." You know, you aren't going to tell your wife that. You know, so you're holding that with
Keeping
burden
it
within
hidden.
yourself.
Yes. Patricia, thank you for joining us.
Oh, well, you're quite welcome.
Patricia Yurovets is board president of the Wisconsin Council on Problem Gambling. If you or someone you know needs help, the National Problem Gambling Helpline is available 24/7 and is the access point for local resources. The number is 1-800-GAMBLER. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We meet a pioneering Wisconsin anthropologist whose decades of research on a critically endangered monkey in Brazil has led to conservation efforts. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a biker's love of adventure.
There's the old saying, not all who wander are lost. This is certainly a motto that writer Ron Davis of Eau Claire lives by, especially if he's out on the road on his motorcycle.
Though it might appear as if any fool can easily get him or herself lost on the road, or really anywhere, losing one's way consistently on a motorcycle actually takes careful study, years of practice, and above all, a special God-given talent for being totally oblivious to how one got anywhere, or where anywhere happens to be. At the risk of sounding immodest, I am such a one. Before I became a rider, I became aware of my special talent when my dad took me trout fishing for the first time. We separated, he headed upstream and me down. He told me I couldn't get lost as long as I stayed next to the creek. After an hour of fighting tangled fishing line, hooks snared in trees, and catcher's mid-sized mosquitoes, in my abundant 10-year-old wisdom, I decided to head back to the car, disregarding my dad's instructions and cutting cross-country. Within minutes, I had lost sight of the creek, and everything took on an alarming state of sameness. No country road, no car, but instead there were lots of spooky-looking trees, swampy sinkholes, and dark thickets, presumably hiding that hideous creature from the Black Lagoon, which I had lately become convinced was real and probably living beneath my bed. My talent for getting lost not fully developed yet, I didn't blunder blindly on, but started yelling for my dad. Help! It seemed appropriate, and Dad was able to come to a somewhat less than nurturing rescue. Motorcycling opened a whole new universe of possibilities for honing my talents. More than once, I found myself in the bowels of the labyrinth-like roads that snake through Wisconsin's Driftless area, a two-wheeler's mecca. Looking for virgin trout water, I often jumped without hesitation from state highway to county trunk to town road to gravel and finally to cow pasture track. I found farmers especially happy to give me directions, at least as far as their property lines. Absolutely the first rule in getting lost is going where you've never gone before. This spring, after mentioning I was looking for some new lakes to explore with my kayak, some kindly moto compadres took me back into an area near Bloomer, littered with some of Wisconsin's more than 10,000 lakes. Cheeseheads are a bit more liberal with the definition of lake than Minnesotans. After miles squirming down nameless gravel roads, chasing my guide's taillights through swirling clouds of dust, I began to get suspicious, wondering if these guys were actually bent on playing some cruel prank. Were they trying to get me lost? Please, they could have deserted me after the second turn, and I'd still be out in the sticks, subsisting on grubs, talking to a pet wood tick, and wearing my bike's tank bag as a rain hat. Somehow, I kept up, never giving them the satisfaction of witnessing my true powers. Lately, with an even more finely developed skill at getting displaced, I've become a genius at turning short rides in northwest Wisconsin into unplanned detours. What lies behind these countless forays into the unknown? some deep-seated mystical compulsion to liberate myself from convention? The lure of adventure? The famous living in the moment? Nah, frankly, I'm mystified, as is my wife, never a fan of my exceptionalism. She sometimes calls me to ask if I have any idea where I am. My usual response is, of course I know where I am. I'm right here.
Ron Davis is a writer who lives in Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every single Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A Wisconsin anthropologist and primatologist has made it her research mission for over four decades to understand and protect the northern Muriqui monkey in the Atlantic Forest of Brazil. Be part of this conversation about primate conservation. Call in with a question. Share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Karen Stryer is Vilas Research Professor of Anthropology at UW-Madison. Karen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
You've been studying the Muriqui for decades now. What first drew you? What first interested you about them?
I was interested in the Muriquis because back in the 1980s, there were a lot of different theories about the evolution of primate social behavior. And I was searching for a primate species that very little was known about, but might be a good test of these models that were mostly developed on primates in Africa and Asia. And I read about the Muriquis and heard about them through a film that had been produced by the World Wildlife Fund and was able to go spend a summer just to get to know them. And the first time I saw them, I fell in love with them. So I guess that's the beginnings.
What is unique about the northern Muriquis? Can you bring us closer to them?
So what I knew about them when I first went to Brazil was that they had anatomical features that were consistent with primates that eat a lot of leaves, as well as characteristics that are consistent with primates that eat a lot of fruit. And those were the two main divisions, to simplify it, for understanding how different kinds of social organizations evolve. When I first saw the Muriquis, I could see that they were going to be a great study species because of these two alternative kinds of pathways they could have taken. And so it was just a question of trying to map on what they actually did with these bodies and teeth that they have relative to what we predicted that they would be. And what captured my interest from the first year was of intensive research was really that they're unlike any primates we had known before, most notably because of their peaceful, egalitarian societies.
Yes. What is it? Why are they considered so peaceful? What are their mannerisms like?
So Muriquis are these large, they weigh about 20 pounds. Because their bodies are like giant spider monkeys, they have long arms, long legs, prehensile tails. And males and females are the same body size and they have the same canine size. So there's no sexual dimorphism that usually in most primates gives males a physical advantage over females. In the Muriquis world, males and females are the same size, and that kind of changes the nature of their dynamics, both among males and among females, as well as between the sexes. It means that females have a lot of autonomy, and there's not a lot of benefits to males for engaging in aggressive competition to attract mates. Females have a lot of choice, and they assert it.
What are their social structures like? How do their families interact? What is that like?
So Morikis live in what we call male-bonded societies. The males stay in their natal groups for life, the groups that they're born in. So the relatedness among males is much greater than it is among females. The females leave their natal groups when they're in adolescence and join new groups where they reproduce. And this is a phenomenon of having one or sometimes both of the sexes leaving their birth groups. Is something that's very common in animals as a way of avoiding inbreeding, close inbreeding, and all the potential genetic disadvantages of that. But it's also something that it means that males are related to one another. So they're kind of a brotherhood. And it also means that sons spend their entire lifetimes with their mothers, because once their mothers are start reproducing, they stay in the group that they're in, that they reproduce in for their lives. So we've got these long patrilines of relatedness with the mother still present. And then the females are independent. They leave their groups. They explore other groups when they can, when they have options. And they find a group that they like, and that's where they establish themselves as reproducing social members. So they live in these large multi-male, multi-female groups. They don't fight very often with one another. Most of their social interactions are affiliative. They hug each other and they sit close together. So, you know, males spend about 60% of their waking hours within a few meters away from other males. And that gives them opportunities to reach out and touch each other, put their hand on one another's shoulders. If anyone gets scared, they're there. They have their allies close by. And pretty much their social dynamics are peaceful, very affiliative. And when they are in situations that would in other primates might provoke conflict, either they wait patiently for their turn or they avoid one another.
Wow. Wow. Do you think you have become a more peaceful person through their spirit?
I definitely think, you know, one of the things that happens when you're observing wild primates, you know, day in and day out, is that you do really think about, you kind of get into the spirit of their pace of life. When they rest, you rest. When they get up, you get up. And so I would say that I definitely think they're good models for human behavior. I think about this a lot, especially now with what's happening with all the violence in the world, and how the Morikis could give us all a good lesson on a peaceful society.
UW Madison anthropologist Karen Stryer studies northern Muriqui monkey conservation in Brazil, and there's space to talk. Call in with the question. You can share your perspectives, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with UW-Madison anthropologist and primatologist Karen Stryer about her life work studying the critically endangered northern Muriqui monkey of Brazil, considered one of the world's most peaceful primates. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Karen, primatologist Jane Goodall visited Wisconsin in the spring, and WPR Central Time spoke with her. Goodall explained how scientists used to think that humans were unique with their intelligence and their emotional capacity.
Science had to change its mind. And now we know that not only apes and elephants and whales are highly intelligent, but so too are pigs and rats, and so too are birds, and so too are octopuses. So, you know, the animals are very different from what people used to think.
What can you tell us about the intelligence and the emotional capacity of the Northern Mariki?
Well, we often think about intelligence associating it with things like relative brain size to body size. But I think that we have, as we've learned more and more about primates and other animals and the complexity of their social relationships and social worlds, we understand that they have deep emotional lives. And I think everybody who has a pet at home understands this intuitively. We all know how our cats and dogs, how much they love us and how disappointed they are when we don't, when we leave them, or when they see us getting ready to go, or when we don't have their favorite toys and treats. And I think that with wild animals like the Mariki's and other primates, we're looking at animals that live in rich, complex social worlds where they're tuned into one another's relationships. My research team just published a paper a year or so ago that was a 20-year accumulation of all of the instances in which mothers carried their babies after their babies had died. And, you know, this was, again, something we don't know. We can't measure. We can't ask them how they feel. Are they sad? Do they know what's happening? And yet, you know, a healthy baby can cling to its mother by itself. And these mothers somehow understood that their dead infants were unable to do that because they would support themselves with their hands. It's very hard to see an animal do something like that, sometimes for days, and not attribute to them some kind of appreciation for the emotions that humans feel as well.
Help us walk in your shoes in Brazil. How do you go about studying social primates in the wild?
It's pretty much a question of waking up before they do in the morning, going to where you hope you left them the night before and hope that they're still there. This takes some practice to figure out what time of year they wake up, what time of day they wake up, and that changes across the year as the days get longer and shorter. And then staying with them, keeping up with them as much as you can for the entire day. This can mean walking up and down hills for miles and miles all day. I think in one day, my cell phone recently told me I had walked about 95 flight equivalents just in half a day. I'm not even noticing it. So it's really just staying with them and recording what they're doing. But throughout all of this, part of staying with them and trying to document their behavior is also the reality of how endangered they are. And that I work, most of my research has been conducted in a small forest fragment. So it's surrounded by pastures and farmland. And this is one of the last refuges for this entire species. There's about 12 populations of Mariki's, and we're really looking at the end of a line, of a lineage, unless we can help protect their habitats and make sure that the populations are protected and can grow and be well managed.
What is happening to the habitat in the Atlantic Forest?
So the Atlantic Forest was a region that was basically cut long ago. A lot of the area was deforested. It's the southeastern Brazilian Atlantic Forest. That's where all the major Brazilian cities are, like São Paulo and Rio de Janeiro and Minas Gerais, Vitória. So it was a major region for agricultural development and urban development and the ports to the Atlantic Ocean along this coast. And so the forest has been fragmented. What remains of the Atlantic Forest is just small pockets. Some of it is under state and federal protection in Brazil, but the larger forests often suffer from hunting pressures. And in the smaller privately owned forests, many of them have been turned into protected reserves by the owners. But even those, the forests there are protected and the animals in them are protected. but they're like islands in the middle of pasture. And unless we can find ways to reforest and build corridors that connect these different patches, then eventually the populations become basically too small and too closely inbred and don't have much of a future. So one of our biggest goals in the research right now is to learn and we've been learning a lot over the last 40 years, my team and other teams that work with us. And we've been documenting what the Murikees do and what they need, what kinds of habitats they prefer, what kinds of foods they prefer, what kinds of social groups they need to live in. Even just the idea that males stay in their natal groups and females disperse, like I was mentioning earlier, give us a lot of insight into managing them. So we're right now very prioritizing connecting the main forest that I work in with another that's about 30 kilometers away that has one group of Murikees. And it's already been legally declared that there should be a corridor here. And now it's just a question of planting trees in areas that connect the little stepping stones of forest, most of them privately owned, to one another so that the Murikees can have a highway that they can take, their own pathway.
They need their own passageway. Yes.
Exactly. Exactly. And I mean, that's also going to protect them and other animals from the impacts of climate change, because it will give them escape routes from habitats from local areas that get too hot or too dry, or that are severely impacted. If we can help them find ways so that they can move into more suitable areas.
Karen Stryer, in our last 30 seconds or so, does this species still surprise you? Are there new things to learn?
It's amazing. You would think that there aren't, but actually I would say every day I spend with the Murikees, every time I see them, I'm just impressed by how much more they have to teach us.
Oh, wow. So when you go out there into the forest every day, there's these little aha moments.
There are, and there's also moments about why after 40 years we're still worried about their conservation. I think as I get older, I'm getting impatient with with the world. It's a real story where we know what we need to do. We have the people, we have the animals, we have the forest,
and it's time
we
to do it.
We
yes.
have the ways.
Karen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Karen Stryer, Vilas Professor of Anthropology at UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.